And we are back. Thank you for sticking with us, and thank you for joining us. This is another one of our after-hours segments. And we've come to do this because of the the scheduling nightmare we've had with interviews so far this summer, the majority of which have been my fault. The firm has gotten bigger, and the responsibilities have gotten bigger, and my schedule is not nearly as elastic as it used to be, and it's taking me a little bit of time to wrap my head around that. The other culprit has been the fact that we've got two children with summer birthdays. And so summer, you know, anyway, you guys know how all this works. So there were some things that I wanted to get to in the show that we didn't have a lot of time to get to. And I was prompted by a client portfolio review I had with one of my favorite clients. Lives in Wyoming, doctor. And we always have fun chats. And we always go way over, too. We usually schedule like a 30-minute portfolio review, and he and I end up talking at least for an hour to hour and a half. But in the course of our conversation today, we started talking about the state of the economy and, most importantly, the state of the markets. And I think we all know that we live in, to be kind, we live in a time, a culture, and a financial market, and a financial, you know, network, a financial system that really does not conform to traditional metrics. I'm speaking in politically correct terms here. Things are odd, right? It's a different day, you know, on so many different levels. This is a very unique period of time. And one of the things that this cycle has taught me, it's taught me a lot, but the line that my grandfather used to say to me repeatedly has really been baked into my brain, that, and I can hear the words even today. It's, Zachary, just because something is imminent, or excuse me, just because something is inevitable doesn't mean it's imminent. And things can go on much longer than you think they can. And I think that this cycle is really the embodiment of that. And I have no problem admitting it. You asked me 5 years ago if the S&P would be at, you know, what are we at? 42, 43, whatever. Shoot, I'm already losing track. It's gone up so much, I don't even know what to do. You know, at 4387, right? 4400. I probably would have laughed in your face because, you know, the market was tired even back then. Valuations were accelerated. But then Trump gets elected and there's tax cuts and there's all that other kind of stuff. So these things can go on much longer than you think. But this cycle is even that on steroids. And what I mean by that is that at no other time in the United States, and for that matter, the vast majority of developed markets around the world, and I'm trying to think of an exception, I can't think of one, there's been something incredibly unique about this cycle, which is the willingness, the total willingness of central banks around the world to print money and fill in the holes. And the reason that's important, and the reason I harp on that so much, is because if you think about that, and the Federal Reserve has said this in and of, they've said these words, that they have basically resolve themselves to take the risk of a liquidity crisis off the table, right? They are not going to allow another 2008, 2009 to occur. They're just not going to do it. And what does that mean? What that means is that the reason stocks fall, let's think about a stock market collapse or a stock market crash, or even just a market, you know, a recession and a market pullback. Stocks go down because, yeah, they're not making as much money. And when stocks don't make as much money, even if it's on the, you know, for instance, if we had a really bad recession, a company like Apple would get hit. Their stock would go down, and that would be a reflection of them not making as much money. None of us are worried about Apple going bankrupt. It's kind of hard to go bankrupt when you got, what is it, you know, $350 billion of cash sitting on the balance sheet. But that's an extreme example, right? Let's think about the energy markets. Why are so many of these oil stocks trading so far below their traditional valuation in environments where oil was at $70 a barrel? Well, there's threats of default, right? There's the whole electric vehicle narrative, which is we're not going to need oil. There's the fact that those companies had to take on a lot of debt, right? And if you had a liquidity crisis like we did in 2008, and what do I mean by a liquidity crisis? I think one of the things that people don't really understand about markets is that the price you see on the screen is the price of the last transaction. What happens in a market where, for whatever reason, the bids dry up, there is nobody offering a buy, right? On the face of it, the price of any security that doesn't have a bid goes to zero. And that's exactly what happened in, you know, the collateralized debt markets in 2008, 2009. It wasn't that people didn't realize that there were good assets in those collateralized vehicles. It was that they had no idea what was good and what was bad. They couldn't buy it because they didn't know what the value was and they didn't know what the risk was. So the market went no bid. And if you think about a market should be pricing in all potential outcomes and all known information and all known risks at all times. That's an efficient market. And then we look back at, you know, the average valuation of markets. I think on the, you know, on the S&P 500 going back for the last 100 years or so, that average valuation has been about a 16 price to earnings ratio. That valuation has always priced in the risk of liquidity crunches, right? Liquidity events. And that risk has essentially been taken off the table. And the interesting thing about that, now, guys, I'm not saying there's not going to be another big crash. Of course there will be. There always will be. There's always going to be run-ups and there's always going to be crashes. That's the way it works. But what I'm saying is we've taken a big departure from norms. Now, just bear with me because this isn't another central bank diatribe. It really isn't. This is going to be about what we do about it and what and where the big opportunities are. And you're going to hear me use a term, where the pressure relief valve, and I'll explain what all that means. But my whole point in saying that this is an incredibly unique period of time, that this is the first time in history that governments have been printing money hand over fist and simultaneously worried about deflation, right? It's flipped a lot of our understandings of economics on their ear. And when you think about that, that should be reflected in the price of stocks. And that's why the one thing I've told people, even the most bearish people, is I look at them and I go, listen, the types of crashes you're talking about, like 2008, those were liquidity crises. The Fed's taking that risk off the table. They're not going to let it happen. But the funny thing about risk is that you don't ever get rid of it, right? You can kick it down the road. You can transfer it. You can repackage it. You can remold it, but you never get rid of it. It's there, right? It's the old adage, everybody pays the piper. Eventually the piper gets paid, right? Eventually that risk gets realized. It can get transformed, but it can't get eliminated. And so we were going down this process and he's like, you know, Zach, what do you think about this risk? What do you think about that risk? And I asked him a question. I said, have you heard of a term called event-driven? So there's funds out there that are event-driven funds, meaning that they're looking to take advantage of big dislocations. You know, event, the easiest one to point to would be 2008, 2009. Right? Unfortunately, too many of those event-driven funds missed that play, but some of them hit it, and they did the whole shorting of the mortgage-backed securities and the collateralized debt obligations, and they made a killing, right? They used the credit default swaps. That's an event-driven type investment, right? In other event-driven funds, you know, probably capitalized on the whole COVID thing. We did too, but in a different way. You know, we manage retirement money, so we can't, you know, we're not playing with options and futures and things like that. but my point is that if you talk to a lot of event-driven guys that run these funds, and I've had the privilege of talking to several of them, One of the things you'll hear them, there's several different things that they have in common. One of the things you'll hear them talk about is, you know, pressure points, pressure relief points. Yes, we see this issue, and the central bank is masking this issue, but we all know that that risk can't be eliminated. It can get transferred, it can get mutated, it can get moved, but that risk is going to come out. So where that risk comes out, that's our pressure relief valve. And if we can figure out where that risk is coming out, there's a lot of money to be made from that, right? Because when that pressure relief valve gets hit, it's going to change the complexion of the landscape. Because now all of a sudden this risk that's been transmuted and transferred and mutated, now all of a sudden it's being realized and no one knows how to contain it because it's changed forms. And I really think that that's what's on the horizon. I really think even more than a catastrophic collapse in markets, that's the issue that we're going to be looking at. And what do I mean by that? So the scenario we've got is you're not going to see in this environment a cataclysmic crash like we had in 1929, 2008, 2009, because we live in a world that is denominated in U.S. dollars, right? U.S. dollars are considered the most pristine collateral. If you're a bank in Thailand and things start getting dicey, you want to get your hands on as many U.S. dollars as you can. And if that government is willing to endlessly print trillions of dollars to fill in those holes, you're not going to see that kind of cataclysmic deal. And if flooding the market with capital doesn't do it, what did they show us last March? They'll step in and buy it. They'll just step in and buy it. Right? And that's a game changer. What did you hear from the Fed minutes this week? That the Fed put up a standing repo facility for $500 billion and that Jay Powell has the unique discretion and very much unmitigated discretion to increase that standing repo facility at any point to as high as he wants to. It's unlimited. That's another, the reason they did that was to protect markets, quote unquote, protect markets, but it's also a shot across the bow. It's sitting there saying, hey, we're not going to let a liquidity crisis happen. We're not going to let it happen. If we have to flood the entire world with US dollars, we're not going to let it happen. So we as investors need to take that. And guys, I fought it. I know that there are many out there going, oh, Zach's turned over to the perma bear bull side now. And he's, you know, everything. It's not that at all. I still see all the problems. My tune hasn't changed. I'm just telling you that in this environment, they're at the helm. They got control. Right? What's the easiest way to make an insolvent company solvent? Put $1 billion in their balance sheet. Boom. Bankruptcy risk is gone. Right? So does that mean markets will go up forever? No. What it means, in my opinion, is that they're just transferring that risk. And so one thing we've spent a lot of time thinking about over the last 8 to 10 years, and specifically over the last year since COVID, because, right, the stuff they did during COVID isn't new. It's what they've been doing since the financial crisis. They just did it on steroids. They broke down all limitations. Rather than trying to talk the market up, they went into the market with hard dollars and started buying it up. Right? That's a significant change. But it's just they're traveling down the same highway. They're just going at a faster speed. Right? So you have to believe that. You may be a skeptic and go, oh, something's going to tie the Fed's hands. And I agree with you, but it's not going to be what you think it is, because they're not going to quit printing. So where is that pressure relief valve? So if you listen to the regular show this week, you heard us talk about the discrepancy in electric vehicles and copper prices. And my basic point was this: you can't have one without the other, right? The average electric vehicle requires 5 times the amount of copper. And I'm using this because there's a lot of these scenarios. I think uranium's in a similar situation. I think oil and natural gas to an extent are in the same situation. I think cobalt fits that. I think to a certain degree, gold and silver fit that. Right? There's a lot of these stories, but I'm focusing on this one because I think this is the one that is the most widely relatable to the, you know, most retail people. Everybody knows about the electric car, the evolution of the electric car and the opportunity that's posed, the amount of money that people have made investing in that play. And I think it fits the bills perfectly about, you know, kind of the dislocations that we're currently looking at. And so if you're one of these people that believes in the electric vehicle, you know, transformation, if you will, I agree with you. I think it's a better car. I think that the only real disadvantage to those cars is range. And that is like the I kind of think of that as like processing power for computer chips. It's one of those, it's just going to get better. You've got too many brilliant minds, too much money being focused on making that range better, getting higher capacity batteries. That's going to come in time. And for, you know, for that, you know, less weight, significantly less maintenance costs, no emissions, right? There's all these advantages. And to me, it just, you know, that's going to happen. Well, everybody knows that. And if you don't believe me, just go look at the price of anything related to electric vehicles, except the commodities they're going to need. So, for instance, I look over at copper, and I look at copper miners, and I look at the complete lack of capital that's flown into that space over the last 10 to 15 years. And I'll just tell you right now, if the electric vehicle people are right on the longer term, which I think they are, I think it's hard to argue they're not, the world's going to need a lot more copper. And it's needing increasingly more copper every single day. Now, copper's had a nice little run here. But when you look at the imbalances, meaning I don't really see anything that is going to create, is going to take copper's place. I don't see any big section of the economy that has used copper in the past that's no longer going to use it. I just see this huge part of the economy that all of a sudden is going to need 5x more. And guys, probably even more going forward, because I think copper is probably going to be, I'm not an engineer or a scientist. But as range becomes more important, so does the conductivity of the metals used in those, right? Because the more conductivity, the more efficient, right? The chances are the need for copper will climb. Now, maybe eventually they'll have some breakthrough technologies and it'll fall, which wouldn't surprise me. But what will make it fall? How do we think about this, right? In terms of business and economics, what will make the price, what will make those companies come up with an alternative technology will be that copper gets too expensive. Okay, well, you're a long ways away from that. And ironically, I think that this is the place where the pressure release valve happens. They're not going to let a traditional default cycle occur. They're not going to let a liquidity crunch or a liquidity crisis take place. And remember, doubt them if you want to. But when you have the unmitigated ability to print as much of a currency as you want to, you can prevent defaults. You can make the stock market go to new all-time highs in the greatest economic shock in history. If you doubt their resolve or their ability, I would tell you to look at the last year and a half. But that risk can only be transferred. It can only be mutated. It's not going to go away. So let's now take a little bit of a mental exercise and sit back and say, what does a world look like where large-scale system-wide defaults are taken off the table? And if they can't talk the market up, they'll just start stuffing trillions of dollars into it like they've been doing. Everybody's like, well, they're not doing it anymore. The Fed is still spending $120 billion a month on asset purchases. I've said this before multiple times, but if you don't think that's a lot of money, let's travel in time back to 2007 and think about TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program that they used to quote unquote save the global financial system. That created a firestorm up on Capitol Hill. The political debates were deafening. The Republicans voted it now down once and then had to come back and re-vote and then finally passed it. That was for $900 billion. That was just in 2008. The Fed is spending one-sixth of that or whatever every month. I think about that. With no defined timeline on when that's going to stop. So they can prevent that. But where is that pressure release point? So let's sit back and think of, like I was saying, let's do a little mental exercise. really conceptualize that in a world that money does not mean what it used to be. Money is infinite now. What isn't infinite? People are like, Bitcoin. That's true. But companies don't need Bitcoin to run. Okay, what is infinite? What can't you print? What is finite? What is valuable? It really is the commodity space, right? Probably, and I'm not saying to get rid of your gold and silver, but probably more so even the industrial metals like lead, like zinc, like copper. They're probably going to be even, you know, in greater demand. Why? Because companies need that to keep running. They don't have a choice. You want to make electric vehicles, you better have a straight line supply of copper. You don't have a choice. You want to improve the range of those electric vehicles, you better have a supply of copper. You don't have a choice. Now, what's interesting about that is when you look at the natural resource sector as a whole, I mean, the thing has basically been in a nuclear winter, you know, and you've seen a pop in the price of gold and silver, but when you compare them in relation to the value of financial assets and all that kind of stuff, they're not high at all. I mean, they're not far off all-time highs, especially gold, but I mean, you know, it has not kept pace with financial markets, specifically over the last 15 years. Over the last 20 years, it looks a little bit better. But, you know, you look at copper. I mean, this housing boom that we're in right now has pushed copper back up close to record highs. But that really, to me, that's kind of more transitory because you just had this massive supply jump out of nowhere after mines had been shut down, right, because of COVID. So once again, you had a jump up in demand and a crunch in supply at the same time. That's always going to boost the price. But because of the success of the tech companies, because of the incredible growth those tech companies have put forward, and because of the record low economic growth we've had in this country over the last 13 years, and the challenge growth we've had globally, you have not seen investments in natural resources. You look across the metals I just named. Most people are surprised to find out that on balance, you look at all those different metals and natural resources I just talked about, there are less mines and there are less operators producing those than there were even 15 years ago. Now, global population has gone up, significantly so. Economies have grown. All the capital has flowed toward tech. Growth, right? All this stuff, Beyond Meat, AMC, defunct movie theaters, right? And if they're going to keep pumping this money, and they're going to keep it, which they will, they have to, they're married to it, they painted themselves into a corner. If they're going to keep pumping this money, where's the pressure relief valve? In our opinion, based on where we're looking at today, I think that breaking point, I think that convex investing opportunity is the natural resource space. And what makes me especially excited about it, and I was alluding to this just a few minutes ago, but what makes me especially excited about it is not just the supply-demand setup, not just the fact that I think the world is going to need more of these, like copper, the world's going to need more of these going forward than they currently do, and it's not going to be a gentle curve upwards, right? Look at all the projections of EVs. Okay, now just replace that chart with copper, right? Because that's how much that demand for copper has to go up. And when you get into that side of it, natural resources, central banks can't print those. Software updates can't fix those, right? Elon Musk's brilliance cannot conjure copper out of the ground. And that, to me, married up with the fact that no capital has flown into those, it's negative capital, has flown into those areas, and those securities are all dirt cheap. That when I look out on the landscape today, I think that is the biggest convex investment opportunity that I've identified, that I can see. I think that's where the pressure relief valve is, because when that demand, driven by central bank money printing, and they're going to print it until inflation becomes a problem, until that growth really starts ramping, and then that inflation takes hold, people are going to turn around and realize, wait a second, we don't have enough copper. We don't have enough lead. We don't have enough natural gas. We fill in the blank. And they're going to go, okay, well, where are the new mines coming online? Then they'll look around, none. What are we going to do? And you're going to see a flood of capital, right? You're going to see a flood of those same dollars that central banks created flooding into those places because they've got to. And what's the Fed going to say? What are central banks around the world? Oh, quit bidding up copper. No, they can't. Right? Because if they quit bidding up copper, if they control the price of copper, or if they try to push the price of copper down, and again, I'm just using copper as an example, they won't have enough supply. If you don't allow the price of copper to go up as a central bank, nobody's going to open a new mine. They're not going to want to invest the hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, to get that mine into production. And so trying to sit around and envisioning what is an issue that's going to pop up that central banks can't deal with, and that's it, guys. It's that inflation side of it. But I don't think it's going to be inflation in the way that you think. I don't think all of a sudden we're going to see the currency collapse. I just think you're going to see the price of these underinvested natural resource type areas of the market get hit by these floods of cash that the central banks have created. And I think you're going to see that stuff go absolutely nuts. And that's that pressure relief point. And that's so important because when you get one of those right, you know, the gains can be breathtaking. You know, the uranium one alone, I know of a fund manager, very brilliant guy, off the wall too. He, unique character, name's Mark Hart. I don't know him, but he knows a lot of people that I know, and I'm a fan of his. He's a very brilliant, smart guy. And he ran a fund. There was a similar setup. It had different characteristics about it, but there was a similar setup in 2004, 2005 of uranium, where uranium prices had gotten beat down, lower than the cost of production. And he made big outsized bets. As a matter of fact, I think he put his entire fund in junior uranium miners. And I think it was 2005, he was down like 53%. And then 2006, uranium bounced back and he was up like 380. Right? Just incredible return, especially at that time and place. You know, credit default swap, not quite that big in magnitude, but an incredible return over a very short period of time. And I see similar setups in so many different of these natural resources and commodity plays. And like I said, the thing that intrigues me the most about it is when I sit around and think about and stare at the ceiling, because I do that sometimes. I would advise everybody to do it, that there are times where I'll just check out for an hour and just kind of get lost in thought. And I try to play what we call the what next game, you know, where you run through scenarios and you go, okay, if that were to occur, what is the natural market reaction to that? And then what is the reaction to that? And it doesn't always, right? You can't always anticipate all those moves, but there's many times where that line of thinking, that what next, playing it through, walking it through, has unveiled incredible trades. I'll give you one. What year was that? When they first raised rates, was it 2015? I believe it was the end of 2015 where we had the first rate raises coming out of the financial crisis. Didn't last long, obviously. And one of the interesting things from 2011 to 2015, gold got slaughtered. Went from 1936, which I believe was the all-time high, and dropped down to 1050. So almost a 50% pullback. And one of the big narratives over that period of time was rising interest rates are bad for gold, right? So when interest rates go up, gold's going to get hammered. Well, interest rates were at zero. The economy was quote unquote, you think about it, right? Remember the term green shoots? The growth and inflation were right around the corner. So interest rates were about ready to go up. And that's why gold kept getting sold, because everybody knows when interest rates go up, gold goes down. Well, the funny part about that is that that's not true. Now, if you want to look at a more encompassing way of thinking about this, something you could say in general, and I got to check because I think there's even exceptions to this, but when real rates go up, gold goes down. And what do I mean by real rates? When interest rates are above the rate of inflation. So let's say the rate of inflation is 2%, rates are at 3.5%, the 10 years at 3.5%, and the rate of inflation stays at 2% and the 10-year goes to 4%. That is an increase in real rates. And in that environment, gold would go down. But just saying interest rates one way or the other is kind of foolish. And here's what I mean. First of all, we have to define what the inflation rate is. Okay, what we have today, the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, it's a far cry from the way that we looked at inflation back in the 70s. Okay, so to equate the two today is a fallacy. They're not equatable. You're not comparing apples to apples. It's a completely different ballgame. So I would tell you right now, I don't think anybody really knows what the inflation rate is. I'll tell you what, I think it's a heck of a lot higher than the 2.2% that they're saying it is. I don't think anybody really buys that. I don't think they buy it. But what I'm saying is we can't just break it down mathematically and say where real rates are currently. Right? I don't think anybody really knows. I think we can get some close guesses. But you know, a definitive answer, we don't know. But if we're just going to operate on the blind assumption that gold goes down when rates go up, explain the 70s. Explain the early 80s. That was the biggest run-up in gold and the fastest rising interest rates in history. Now, during most of that time, I will say real rates were negative, meaning inflation was running hotter than interest rates. And so that traditionally is a good environment for gold. Now, why do I bring this all up? Because I'm referencing the efficacy of that what's next type line of thinking, right? That walking down the chain and saying, okay, I kind of equate it to playing chess, right? Seeing moves in advance. If I move here, this person's probably going to move their rook over here. And then if they do that, I should probably move my bishop here. And when I do that, they'll probably move their pawn over here. And then I'll do this, and that will move their queen right here. And then boom, the trap is set, right? It's the same basic type of thinking that we try to deploy in chess. And again, it doesn't always work. But my thought process at the time was I thought it was going to be a sell the news event. So the way that we approached it was, if gold goes up for two consecutive trading days after the first rate raise, we're going to go into gold heavy. So we did that. From that moment, over the next 60 days, maybe it was 90 days, gold rallied 25% and the gold miners we were in doubled in about a 90-day period of time. And then thank God we got out of there because then more volatility returned to gold markets. And it was a great trade. Now, it doesn't always work that way, but my point is saying I look at financial market, and to get back to that, why was I targeting that? Because I knew the narrative that everybody was pitching that was causing everybody to sell gold, I knew the narrative was wrong. And so wait for that narrative shift, wait for that thing to come. It's kind of a sell the news event type deal, and then jump on gold. And that was the idea for the trade. And it just so happened to our benefit that we were right. We nailed that one. And I think using that same type of logic, sitting there going, okay, where does this thing hit the skids? Many people, even before I said it, was like, you know, this thing ends. Central banks can no longer bail out every part of the economy when inflation becomes the problem, right? Because if inflation is the problem and they start trying to bail out companies more with more printed money, all they're going to do is push inflation higher, right? That's kind of where the rubber meets the road. So then looking at that scenario and going, okay, what can't they control? It's going to be the commodity side of it. Because think about the investments that have gone into electric vehicles. Think about the investments that have gone into all. On just a simple level, you've got an incredible imbalance in investments. You're building up these sectors over here like EVs that are going to require more of the commodity, but you haven't built up the commodity. And there is no company called copper. The central banks can't just step in and, you know, they can't do the same thing they do with securities. They can't do the same thing they do with bonds. They can't hold down the price of copper. They may try to talk it down, but there's no mechanism they can really do. And like I said, if they do that, in a way, they're kind of cutting their own throat, because if they succeed in pushing those prices down, those sectors won't attract the capital, right? What makes capital flow into a sector? It's when things are going up. And I just look at that as that perfect moment where all of a sudden Pandora's box is going to fling open and the central banks aren't going to know what to do. Now, they'll probably try to get creative, but I just don't think that that's an issue they can fix. And we've spent a lot of time mulling this over, going, okay, where does this, because like I said, this is kind of this magical environment, right? People go bankrupt, you know, we lose all these jobs, send people checks, pay them more to sit at home and play video games, and they're making work in full time. They can't pay their rent, create moratoriums on foreclosures, right? We just keep backfilling printed money. What can hurt us? Well, you can't put a moratorium on copper going up. You can't put a moratorium on gold going up. You can't do it. And if you do it, you're hurting the economy. You know what I mean? There's no way out. Now, it is possible that I'm wrong, but from where we sit here today, that to me, combined with the incredibly low valuations across that entire space, it just screams convex returns to me if you're patient and you can handle some of the volatility. And then there's the other safety thing, which I will just tell you. In this world that we are currently living in, where debt doesn't matter, currency doesn't matter, we can create an electronic currency out of thin air that's a joke and it's got a $50 billion market cap 3 years later, Dogecoin. Right? I call it the Alice in Wonderland market. Right, where you can believe as many as five impossible things before breakfast. Commodities are a different animal altogether. A, God's not making any more of them. And B, because of the cost of materials, oil, equipment, all those other kind of things, they're getting more expensive by the day. The other thing is, every single year that we suck up natural resources, they get harder to find and they get more expensive to pull out, which makes costs go up even more. Now, am I telling anybody to load up? No. Again, you guys know. There's no investment recommendation in here, and I couldn't do it even if I wanted to, unless I wanted to get my license pulled. But what I can tell you is, at the very least, if you're a home gamer managing your money, you need to make sure that natural resources are a position in your portfolio that is commensurate to their traditional weighting in the S&P 500, not today's weighting. And if that means you get slightly worse returns over the next 2 years, so be it. But we are in a minute-to-minute culture, and I'm telling you right now, if you're not thinking long-term, A, I think you're going to miss tremendous opportunities. B, I think you're going to get licked. And you got to look for those pressure release valves. And we're going to keep our eyes on it, guys. That is my thought here. I could be wrong. It's happened before. My wife could give you several examples. But from where we're sitting today, that is going to happen. The world needs more uranium. The world needs more copper. It just does. The world needs more cobalt as of now. And the investments have not been anywhere close to what they need to be to meet those demands. So that is that pressure release valve. And why do we look for those? Because if in the right context, and that's what I love about this, because you can buy a lot of these companies throwing off 4%, 5%, 6% yields. You can buy these companies at less than 10 PEs, you know, a fraction of the overall valuation of the market. We can get them cash flowing. We can get them cheap. We can get them historically cheap. And I just so happen to think that they're the most convex trade, most convex part of the market over the next 5 to 10 years. So the one thing I would say, again, not recommendation, not going to talk specific names, but the one thing I would say is, if you're a home gamer managing your own money, just make sure that you at least have the traditional allocation, not the current. And I believe that, like, for energy, I think the historical weighting for energy in the S&P 500 thing is about 11%. Today it's like 3.5%. I'd have to look into the precious metal space, but I know that that's way below. the average two. And at the very least, I would make sure that my portfolio had the historical average representation. Because right now it doesn't. Right now, every portfolio out there, whether it's ETF, mutual fund, whatever, what you know what you're overloaded in. You're overloaded in tech. With very little, if any, exposure to that kind of stuff. And why? Because it hasn't worked over the last 10 years, and fund managers don't want to own what doesn't work because then money gets taken away from them. Their fund shrinks. They got to go where the performance is. But we don't have to. Now, does that, like you said, does that mean I want you to put 50%? No. I'm not telling you to load up. But what I'm saying is you are light in those areas. If you're in mutual funds, ETFs, whatever, I guarantee you're light. You need to at least get back that historical balance. And if you don't know how to do that, or, you know, you're sitting there going, I don't know how to play it, play ETF, guys, call us. Right? These are, in my opinion, and look, we'll be quick to change. I don't have a crystal ball. I should get one on my desk. You know, it's a joke. And I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not sitting there saying to stick to that trade all the way to the bitter end either. That's the other thing. In a market like this, you know, there's certain things you need to buy and hold, but you better be nimble. Because we all know this market isn't moving on fundamentals, right? I mean, they play a small role here or there, but in a lot of places they don't. It just doesn't matter. And again, remember, just because it's inevitable just means it's imminent. And the other one, markets can stay irrational a lot longer than you can stay solvent. And that's why our attitude is pick up an amount of that kind of stuff that we can live with. And when it drops, we can add money to it. But I think that those, and this is why we manage money. This is why I spend so much more money than the average firm our size to employ two analysts, to have an assistant portfolio manager. Because you're going to need, you need that active management. You need to get in those things when they're working. You need to be able to step aside when they're not. And we talk a lot about the risks out there, but, and they're there and they're going to be realized. But remember, with risk comes opportunity. It's always that way. And that's why I think the narrative or the analog of 1968 to 1983 is so powerful. If you were in stocks and bonds, you got slaughtered over that 15-year period of time. If you were in natural resources, you built tremendous amounts of wealth. And I think that's going to be similar to the phase that we're currently going in. Again, you don't want to load up on it, but you need more exposure than you currently have across the board. I have yet to see another client portfolio walk through our doors that has enough exposure or even the historically normal amount of exposure to that natural resource sector. And I get why they don't. I'm just saying I think that ship has sailed. And if it hasn't, then I think it's time to endure some pain and stick with it and buy more when it goes down, because that's that pressure relief valve. It's going to blow. Anyway, I got to run. I know you guys are probably tired of listening to me pontificate. We're going to be back next week. Like I said, the vacancy or the lack of interviews is going to be made up for in spades next week. We've actually got two on the docket. And I'm not sure if we're going to lease them both next week. We'll have to see how that plays out. But we're getting back on the interview train. So hopefully you guys have been able to suffer through this lack of interviews. Have a wonderful weekend. And as always, we'll be back next week. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.